this is the fourth side of the sixth session, May 30th, 2006. And so you have to keep people entertained. You have to keep industries around the world harmonized. Mines in Africa, plantations in Latin America, whatever kind of industries are involved in this seamless web. They must be shipping and oil tanks moving. All these environments have to be kept relatively efficiently harmonized. All that has to be done. And the management of the disservices and the dissatisfactions that come out of the interaction of all these media environments, that is what the president is responsible for. In other words, huge second nature environments. And so his personal point of view is minuscule in that situation. Mm-hmm. Therefore, as McLuhan said, the president does nothing.
Yeah.
It just keeps waving, saying everything's okay, don't worry, couple problems over there, we'll handle it.
Yeah. Well, he also gives a voice, human voice to the Android meme.
Yes, yeah, a human image.
Yeah.
And we know the Android meme is a culmination of all the language and media and culture and industries that have developed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what humans are doing. They're extending themselves. And that extension begins to look and have the qualities of the interactive nature of language, mm-hmm. of speech. So the word makes the market. So that is, so as I was saying, the president will do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The idea, the role of the president is to maintain the chemical body image and let the environment operate as much as possible. And as a result of that...
Well, of course, Reagan was the really good image to remember of a president who did just that, just waved and said everything's okay. President Bush doesn't do that. He appears to actually be trying to present give his position a human face.
Because we're post-Android meme.
Yeah, we're post...
It's a different world.
Yeah.
But back then, Reagan, he emphasized free trade and privatization, allowing the environments to keep functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at the period when we're getting to the later phase of the Android meme where it's beginning to grind down and it's going to disappear. So Reagan was necessary to, in mid-phase of the development of the Android meme from 1960 to 1990, he was there in the last watch keeping it going.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, staying hands-off management
mm-hmm.
is what he was known for.
Is there a media ecology context in which we can understand his Alzheimer's? Or would you just say that was a chemical body thing and was not, it's not really, you don't look at that from a media ecology perspective?
Well, from the First Nature creator's point of view, the patterns that second nature weaves are always ironic. So in the age of data banks in the 80s that had more information about you than you knew or remembered.
Mm-hmm.
So people, McLuhan wrote, you can read this in the letters, in the 70s, that people now put on forgetfulness as a nostalgic reaction to too much collectivized memory around them.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's on tape about you and everything else in the tribe. Nothing is forgotten. So that's when people began to put on amnesia, social amnesia, as a value, as an anti-environment, an attempt to have an anti-environment to the Android memes, endless recording of everything.
Right.
And so you have a president who's considered a great president because he got amnesia. That's a subliminal message. Because he couldn't remember anything.
Mm-hmm.
All the scandals that came on him and his cabinet ministers, the big defense that came out of that era was, well, I don't recall, right?
Yeah.
They're actually subliminally, like the MySpace pattern, they're expressing what's going on in the public.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking the advantage of amnesia, which the people are using as a service, and throwing it back at them as an alibi for their incompetence,
right.
or perceived incompetence. And so that's why I'm saying, look at the George Bush image. There is something, the low ratings and everything, that it is mirroring and totally resonant with what the people in larger environments that humans are cyborgian and post-cyborgian involved in are reflecting.
Mm-hmm.
So we have endless MySpaces, countered by, no, this is my space. I make the decisions. Well, back in the 80s, when people willingly forgot everything, I mean, there was a great Jules Feiffer cartoon around that period where he showed this woman who decided that she forgot she had a family, forgot she had a marriage, forgot everything, just went off and went autonomous, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That represented a lot of the collapsing more and more of the family and social local responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so the abandonment of the raising of children and the, look now, we have the, why is Bush defunding education and all this local community stuff?
Mm-hmm.
That's an expression of the abandonment of the chemical body. Originally manifest in the Reagan era as the chemical body celebrating amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
Now we don't even worry about what the chemical body remembers. We just ignore the chemical body
mm-hmm.
and any nurturing of it. It's called education. So Reagan's image of amnesia is totally resonant with the effects that everybody's involved in that decade.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't it interesting? He actually, Wilson, did get amnesia. The irony is that you had to have a president who was going to get amnesia to be a charismatic image and offer some veneer of social coherence in the 80s. So nowadays, we need to have a president who appears to be extremely dumb and incompetent to be resonantly harmonious with what the population under present post-Android mean conditions really is reflecting
mm-hmm.
and living.
Right.
So that's the ecology, the figure-ground relationship.
Yeah.
In a world of the Android meme where there's no figure and ground, and then post-Android meme, figure and ground are irrelevant.
Yeah.
It's just clubbing each other. It's
yeah. You know, Bush reminds me of the, who went up against Goliath? Daniel? David? David and Goliath? Yeah. He reminds me of that guy, because he's like, you know, he's got his slingshot, and he's whirling the stone around his head, and he's going to hit the Android meme with it, and
yeah.
You know, he doesn't have to be an intellect to do that. He just has to be, you know, he has to be tough and principled. Yeah,
and that is the Rumpelstiltskin. He's Rumpelstiltskin on the AP Dobbs and post-Dobbs quadrant,
mm-hmm.
throwing a rock at the first four quadrants, the merger of the four bodies. And he's off the charts, on the edge, in an advantage position. It's like the clone DSP put people on the edge in a disadvantaged situation. Now the humans are on the sidelines in an advantage position,
mm-hmm.
as well as in the center of the Android meme, what's left of it. So, yeah, that's a good image. He's Rumpelstiltskin throwing the dart. Rumpelstiltskin now is naming us. We before had to figure out his name. He's naming us by, for example, when he and Cheney, when they were campaigning in 2000, I think, they see the New York Times reporter, and they say, George Bush, the mic's on, he doesn't realize it, or he did realize it, he says, there's Clyde Clymer, I think his name was, there's Clymer, he's an asshole, and then Cheney goes, yeah, big time. But that's him naming the Android meme as an asshole.
Yeah.
And part of his charisma is that he ignores the media.
Yeah.
And the station that supposedly represents the White House is the Fox station, and their news is perceived by the established news, older media, as total fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
So Fox is the only way the Android meme can resonate with Bush. They have to ignore facts and information and present that fantasy as the information coherence, and that resonates with Bush spitting in the face of the information society.
Yeah.
You get my point?
Yeah. I'm just thinking of a little video clip that was floating around a couple of years ago of him. Somebody's got a camera on him, and I'm sure this was never seen on television, and they say something to him, and he goes, well, you know what I have to say about that, and he flips off the camera, sticks his finger right in front of the camera and says, you know, flips the bird.
He does private media ecology.
Yeah.
He's turning off the whole environment. That's Rumpelstiltskin
doing.
That's
kind of a statement of him, of his how he's going to deal with the Android meme, I guess.
Yeah, he has the power to turn it off, which is what the digital media gives you. You can tape and listen and edit and do whenever you want at your own time. You're not inside the broadcast mandate of the 50s, 60s, where you had to be there at the one time the show was on. Mm-hmm. So that commercial, I like that. We need references on that, because that is a perfect resonant image of the Bush era, and which is what all the kids can do. They can turn, they can remote change the channel and blip you off with their instant messaging. So everybody within the Android meme becomes a Tetra manager and then a Pentad manager, which is allowing the environment to be easily turned off. And allowing the environment to run the situation. So the guy didn't have to make a statement. He just allowed the environment to be turned off. So just to wrap up here, I want to, this Rumpelstiltskin is like a hijacker. So I want to read two more quotes from page 9 to finish the page, and I'll read them fast.
Okay.
First one, it says, first paragraph, two paragraphs from, I have here, GR, look in the index. Oh, yeah, this is McLuhan's later Explorations magazine, published in the University of Toronto graduate in the 60s and early 70s. This is from spring 1971. It's called The Hijacking of Cities, Nations, Planets in the Age of Spaceship Earth. So here's a section I took from that.
What page?
Page 111.
No, we skipped disarmament.
So yeah, we might come back to that. But I want the Rumpelstiltskin thing, because Rumpelstiltskin is a hijacker. So this commercial you're talking about hijacked the situation of his responsible challenge to make a chemical body statement. He hijacked it by just turning off the environment. Right? You got that?
Yep.
Okay. So McLuhan says, it will take the hijacking of 5,000 Boeing 747s to equal the simple hijack of a single small city, destination unknown. Both hijackers impose their preferences on service environments designed for others. Both hijackers impose their preferences on service environments designed for others. And hijack can be applied to any environment, the air, a business, a culture, or the nation itself. Remember, the title of this is The Hijacking of Cities, Nations, and Whole Planets in the Age of Spaceship Earth. Because we're into the satellite environment, the solar theater, so you can hijack planets.
Yeah.
Hijacking a business is easier in proportion to the size of the business, as witness the Pennsylvania Central, where $7 billion of assets have been hijacked by the bookkeepers to non-transportation uses. The bigger the operation, the less the shareholders know about the flight plan. And this is resonant to the sentencing of finding guilty of the Enron hijackers.
Mm-hmm.
Big operation, they had a lot they could hijack. Saying here, the bigger operation, the easier it is to hijack it. The bigger the operation, the less the shareholders know about the flight plan. Hijackers don't presume to have expertise. They allow the plane or the business or the country that they take over to be operated by those normally in charge. There's your president hijacking the world and letting everybody run their little environments, right? They allow the plane or the business or the country that they take over to be operated by those normally in charge. The hijacker does not interfere with the operation, but with the flight plan. He decides where to land. And that echoes me saying Nixon could have picked McLuhan, or he could have picked Kissinger, to decide which direction and where to land, right?
Right.
So, reading the first paragraph of that section, it will take the hijacking of 5,000 Boeing 747s to equal the simple hijack of a single small city, destination unknown. In other words, there's many environments you can hijack in a little small city. You're just hijacking an airplane when you do a Boeing 747.
Well, when we think about 9/11, it looks like it only took three airplanes to hijack a city.
Right, but that's under chip conditions. This is under TV conditions here, TV body and satellite conditions. This is, you know, written in 1971. Both hijackers impose their preferences on service environments designed for others, and hijack can be applied to any environment, the air, a business, a culture, or the nation itself. Now, on cliched archetypes, there's a quote above that, because what I just cited was two paragraphs, the bottom of page 9, but in the middle of the page, after we talked about the American dream that has been scrapped, is, of course, that of the open road, which is now merged with Jet City. This, and you know, McLuhan said in the late 60s that the open road dream became a ghetto and was popularized by the movie The Easy Rider, where these guys, as a counterculture move, got on the open road, right?
Yeah, it was popularized by the beat writer, Kerouac. That was the title of his book.
Yeah, what was this book called?
On the Road.
On the Road, not the Open Road.
Yeah, that's
on
right.
The Road. But that was in 57 when it came out. Written before, but published in 57. Now we're talking 67, 68 when Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda make the Easy Rider.
Right.
Which is going on the old environment of the road and blowing your mind. Okay, so Cliched Archetype, page 202 says, disarmament is illogical and futile unless one is prepared to regard the available means of production and social organization as affording unique social ends. To divert electrical energy and circuitry into atomic bombs shows the same imaginative power as wiring the dining room chairs to enable one to electrocute the sitter in the event that he might prove hostile. It is part of the age-old habit of using new means for old purposes instead of discovering what are the new goals contained in the new means. Now, we've spent a lot of time today in this session discussing the Bilderbergers and the Tetra managers managing the older environments. They hijack the new means and the new goals for old purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So they disarmament is illogical. You can't, once you have a new environment, you can't turn it off. Or you got to deal with the consequences of turning it off. And so therefore you only turn it off temporary. And then you turn it back on. But you do that with such frequency that you make people aware of the environment. So for total disarmament is illogical, futile, because you got these bombs and you can't stop the growth of technology. And to do it, he says, unless one is prepared to regard the available means of production, social organization, as affording unique social ends. So disarmament is illogical and futile unless one is prepared to understand that the medium is the message. And he's spelling out the medium as the message by saying, the available means of production, social organization, that's the new medium, that's the new technological, social web of production and effects. If you regard them as a creating, affording unique social ends or new kind of effects, if you think of that, then you can handle the disarmament problem. Otherwise, to divert electrical energy and circuitry into atomic bombs shows the same imaginative power as wiring the dining room chairs, the old environment, the old chairs, wiring them to enable one to electrocute the sitter in the event that he might prove hostile. So the Cold War and the creating a huge overkill, bombs to wipe out many countries, that is taking the old industrial environment and diverting it into a purpose which is molded by the new TV environment, which creates paranoia. So the paranoid software environment forces the Pentagon to wire the chairs or the nations around the world in case somebody becomes extremely paranoid and attacks you.
Yeah.
So you're taking the new operation, which creates new goals and new environments, and you're rear-view mirroring it into old purposes.
Yeah. Well, you have to build in the protection. If you know that the new environment's going to create an upset, then you have to build in the protection, don't you?
Yeah. But the protection is not just protecting the chemical body, you're not protecting the effects of the TV landscape, which created rampant social chaos, drug addiction, pollution of meaning, for the POBs.
Yeah. You know, I just thought of an image of studying the effects. Take a table full of, a glass table, and you dump an ounce of iron filings. And each little iron filing, and maybe you got 100,000 of them on the table, you just smear it across the table. Each one represents some cultural meme that's at stake.
Yep.
And then you come and you take a magnet that's it's certain power, strength, and polarity, and you stick it under the table, and all those iron filings get rearranged in a pattern that's coherent with that magnet. Now, everybody's focusing on studying the magnet, the new technology, but they're not focused on studying the effects that it had on all the cultural memes that all rearranged and realigned themselves because of the effect of that magnet.
Yeah, no, that's a good metaphor.
And it's hard to do. I mean, you got to be pretty comprehensive to be able to see patterns on that scale.
You have to be detached. You have to be willing to go to a rock concert or whatever new music is happening, new galleries, new sports, new people, new mafias, new businessmen. You just look and easy, just read the newspaper or just hear the news and hear what's going on.
Yeah.
And if you know the formula that it's expressing certain sensory alignments that the new media favors,
mm-hmm.
but in this decade or in this century, you realize, well, there are no senses, so it's within the central nervous system, so you look at the patterns of how the word makes the market. So it's a matter of scanning everything and not identifying
mm-hmm.
with the particulars, not being a specialist. You have what McCoon calls imagination, which is a state of detachment or media yoga, and you're looking at what the new fashions and clothes are, and you see if there's a common denominator. And I did at the beginning of this tape. I said, the new environment is MySpace. What does that mean? Well, I remember hearing that Bush said something about I'm the decider, you know, a month or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's trying to declare it's MySpace.
Mm-hmm.
So I was aware. I didn't have an opinion about the character. I didn't care about Bush or anything, just that that's what this entity said, what the White House said. And there's probably other examples that are available if I think about it. You're just absorbing things, and then you know how to bring them together and show what the filings have been rearranged into.
Yeah.
And my chart is a it's like all those little letters on that white chart, this little simple page of print. Think of those letters as filings, and it's been shaped into five columns and five quadrants and a bunch of little words, and they're all organized according to memes. The filings, as they've been organized in the post-Android meme phase since 1990, is right on my chart.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always going to be the Rumpelstiltskin syndrome. And remember, I'm talking about all the pain and culture that the POB saw in the baby boomers. And the baby boomers didn't see it that way. And that's why my quadrant, the Dobbs quadrant, from 1960 to 1990 is ecstasy. We've been in generally a state of ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
In the amazing TV, satellite, computer, seamless web, and then the digitalization of that into user-friendliness, it's been one big good time.
Yeah, well, everybody that knows how to catch the wave and surf it, everybody that wiped out is, you know, they're not having any fun, but...
Oh, yeah, no. There's Schadenfreude. Or there's people that enjoy being unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of information out there to make someone feel unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
So every kind of old psychological posture can be really indulged in today. And every collective posture can be indulged in.
Mm-hmm.
And every non-posture can be indulged in. And every quadraphenic expression can be manifested.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's our punchline.
All right. So with that, to be continued.
Before you turn off the tape, let me just say we did almost two pages. We pretty well did two pages of the McCoon quadrant. So next session we go back to LaRouche. Or go forward to LaRouche.
Mm-hmm.
And he maintains the meme of the chemical body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, I sure hope someone gets to hear this and has having as much fun as I am with it, because I think this is a blast. All right.
Yeah.
Signing off for today.
Okay. This is our seventh session. It's June 3rd, 2006, and this is the first side. And we're now doing page 10. Which is made up of one long quote by LaRouche from his 1973 essay, Beyond Psychoanalysis. So let's see what he has to say, or what I've arranged for him to say at this point after the previous LaRouche quotes, which we've gone over.
Do you want to read it all? Yeah, read it all the way through, or take it a paragraph at a time? Okay.
No, let's work it all the way through first.
The most efficient way in which to identify the distinctions to be made is this. In abstraction of ordinary consciousness, the control of mental productions and communications is associated constantly with notions of one's self. Perhaps the individual ordinarily does not reflect on this, and ordinarily is, therefore, usually unaware of the existence of these executive controls. It's not difficult to provoke such awareness. Indeed, a skillful operator in a therapy group,
in quotes,
or in any group which can be directed to act as a therapy group, in quotes, attention of virtually all participants to such quote-unquote feelings very quickly. Once one has done this several times, the ability to replicate the effect becomes almost automatic. In ordinary states, the form of these notions of ego ideals is what one would best describe as feelings about attributes of a monad-like, quote-unquote, little me. In general, the instant one succeeds in, quote-unquote, cutting through the persona of an individual to force his reflection on these, quote-unquote, feelings, the usual sensation experienced by the, quote-unquote, opened up individual is, quote-unquote, I am a fraud. And in parentheses he has original sin, question mark. There is more or less immediate recognition that the self one presents to the outer world is a synthetic character, a mere persona, a manufactured, and then in parentheses, artificial product created for the propitiatory edification of the credulous. Thus, one's self, as presented to the world, is not, quote-unquote, the real me, not the, quote-unquote, soul. Very quickly, the affected individual can begin to discover and detail how, quote-unquote, I operate. Accompanying this enlarged awareness, there is usually a growing depression associated with the sense that the, quote-unquote, real self is a kind of monad, a, quote-unquote, little me. The fact that such a monad could only be an empty construct forces the individual to regard the criteria, quote-unquote, by which I operate, as necessarily the only existent qualities attributed to the, quote-unquote, little me. Consequently, these being the same qualities associated with the production of the, quote-unquote, fraudulent outer self, the persona, the, quote-unquote, little me, is a degraded thing, intrinsically, quote-unquote, unlovable. And in parentheses, how could God love my miserable little soul? At bottom, in this respect, the effect to get free of the, quote-unquote, inner self.
No, the effect to get at.
To get at.
The effort to get at the,
quote-unquote, inner self, brings us, in the ordinary case, to a little hardball, monad of sorts, from which apparently emanates the qualities, the, quote-unquote, feeling states, quote-unquote, instincts, etc., which one otherwise encounters in cathexis, in consciousness, and semi-consciousness. Ostensibly, any effort to probe the self more deeply, to get, quote-unquote, to quote-unquote, get within the monad, results in locating only an, quote-unquote, it or an id. In fact, precisely such results can actually be obtained. When the same self-analysis is effected in the case of individuals in a state of self-conscious creative production, the phenomena of the monad are not obtained. The ego ideal and notion of the quote-unquote inner self are instead united in a single quality. Examined more superficially, one could obtain the apparent result emphasized by Kubi. At first inspection, the idea
Kubi. Kubi, I think, was the founder of Gestalt psychology, from which McLuhan gets the figure ground terms.
Oh, okay. We always think of that guy associated with Gestalt psychology. Can't remember
Fritz
his name.
Perls?
Fritz Perls, yeah.
Yeah, that's a later version of Gestalt therapy.
Mm.
Not the original.
Mm-hmm.
So at first inspection.
Yeah, at first inspection, the idea of creative activity for its own sake is the ego ideal, a form whose content is the activity of quote-unquote negentropic synthesis
itself.
Accordingly, if one studied artistic and other personalities who are merely creative or only yet potentially self-conscious, one would tend to concur with Kubi's argument that the creative process must be regarded as a virtue in itself.
So, there's a lot in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot in that one.
Yeah. It can be more than other things that we've read. We could take a lot of what was just said and kind of generalize it down to, you know, an idea of what he's pointing to.
Unless you have something to say, I got something to say.
Yeah, go ahead.
The little me and all that stuff. That, the real me, the little me, and the fraudulent nature of it. It seems he's talking about the industrially literate created little me. And since the literate...
Well, the visual space.
Identifying,
it goes back to the earlier thing, which was actually from McLuhan, where Satan identifies with language.
Right.
And thus forgets, the divine intelligence, or, you know, becomes identified with something that's, in a sense, superficial and not real, has no real ground of being, and therefore feels fraudulent or...
Yeah, what did you say? The language, the devil. Because what's interesting to me is that that this little me sensation can be evoked in a therapy group by endlessly provoking the awareness that it's somehow inadequate. He says...
He refers to it as a monad-like little me. Now, what's a monad?
Monad is the term coined by Leibniz, and that's the psychological... It's like an update of Augustine's soul. Remember we talked about the Augustinian psyche, a product of visual space?
Mm-hmm.
And then the industrial space, or post-book space, because Augustine is manuscript space. But the book and early industry... industrial meme is starting to grow, and Leibniz is a figure in the development of that, and he developed the theory of the monads, and it was like a more powerful secular version of the soul, and it was a detached soul. It almost could be the effect of manuscript visual space getting a strange reaction from the new industrial space. But the interesting thing is to put someone in a therapy group and point out its limitations, that does not occur, really, till the 20th century in a pop psychology environment. And that was possible because the little me, the little literate industrial me, was puny compared to the growing additions of the TV body, and or at least the effects of the TV landscape on the being. So this therapy layout could have been done in... This was part of the process in the monasteries, or in secret societies, or in cults, or in the Eleusinian mysteries. There would be these little groups where they would do tribal massage on someone's sense of self. This gets popularized in the therapy group. What's interesting is LaRouche is pointing out the inadequacy of that way of developing negentropic or real profitable self-consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
See, all this thing he's talking about here in the first paragraph or two, at bottom he says, in this respect, the effort to get at the inner self brings us, in the ordinary case, to a little hard ball. Now, the little hard ball is a product of industrial space and maybe even literate space before that. The little hard ball may not be what other cultures, pre-literate cultures, experience. At least this is romanticized by literate mystics.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way that I'm thinking about it is that I distinguish awareness from self-awareness. I think the animals are aware but not self-aware, although in domesticated animals, pets, there may be a rudimentary sense of self-awareness.
Well, maybe you should say instinct and memory. They do have instinct and memory. They react instinctively on memory. They had some experience with you, and then you come back in the room 2 weeks later, and they'll respond to what their memory of you is. So That's
yeah,
a
but
form of self. I mean, another dogma wouldn't have that memory necessarily. So the building
up won't obsess over its thoughts about itself like a human being will.
Yeah. Okay. So it's the memory manipulation, the memory flexibility, the will, the mental will that can play with memory. The animals don't seem to have that ability, because memory is language and a result of language and experience and media, and then the more we can manipulate it, it's like imagination not being involved in any embedment, in any extension, that would include memory, the more playful and storage-oriented we are with that, that's what distinguishes the human.
Mm-hmm.
The animal has memory, but it's limited in its range. And it's totally programmable. They don't seem to have a will. They can't alter, play with it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
they can manifest states of anxiety, which I guess is a form of self-awareness.
Yeah, now you were saying humans obsess over it. Well, that's because we can improvise on it. We can do all kinds of things with it.
Mm-hmm.
We do a tetrad with a memory. You enhance it, obsolesce it, retrieve it, and then flip it into a different memory.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were saying, you started to talk about, start again with that in mind.
Well, okay, people, you know, sometimes,
awareness.
Yeah, sometimes people talk about, victim consciousness, or he's got a martyr complex, or whatever. That is a thought that's deeply rooted in the thought that I am, that, you know, one says, I am anxious. These complexes are rooted in the Eastern guys think that the thought that I am, unless they're talking about cosmic consciousness, but the separate sense of self, the self that feels isolated from all that is, actually is a kind of a daydream or a thought in and of itself, which can be awakened from.
Yeah, but you got to
define what I think.
What you mean by awakened.
It
can be detached from.
Mm-hmm. Detached, okay.
And willfully related to differently.
Right. Well, when there's that in a lot of spiritual teachings, they say, "Well, okay, the fundamental consciousness is I am that I am." And this seems to be some transcendental I that contextualizes all the little I's that we presume ourselves to be from lifetime to lifetime, or the little separate self that feels like it's isolated from all other egos,
yeah,
or I centers, or little me's, monad-like little me's. And it doesn't seem to have any real substance, because it can be, because if it's detached from, it's seen as being just some kind of a thought complex in the brain that causes us to experience ourselves as being an ego. Do you have any comments on where I'm going with this or anything?
Yeah, well, as you talk about the self, the ego, and all these words, I think of them as culturally conditioned, the images around them, and what's coming through, that pierces through and becomes the common factor is, it's one has an image for the big picture and then the image for the little picture. In fact, the mind can think about where we're going or where the operation is headed and pay attention to the means to get there. So yeah, the big picture, or what I think it's Alfred North Whitehead said, the meaning level of thinking, and then the particular specific level of thinking. So the big meaning for your image of where the universe is, this is what I mean by anthropomorphic projection, or anthropomorphic physical, is the human has a big picture of itself in relation to where it sees and experiences itself, and then has its particular image of itself in relation to that and to other particulars.
Right. Like the personal sense of self, I think, is some complex of thoughts and emotions, which could actually be pulled apart, and then it would resolve or dissolve into some larger context, like maybe, well, I don't know what LaRouche means
by a larger image. When you say thoughts and emotions, when you say word thoughts, are you thinking of images?
Well, I want to come at this at another angle, because I haven't been doing a very good job of...
Oh, this is good.
Okay.
It's hard to talk about how the mind works.
Yeah.
You know, this is, you know, we're doing as good as LaRouche is doing.
Right.
LaRouche had time to write it down and cross his T's and dot his I's and make perfect sentences out of it. But he's still wrestling with this mystery, which is, in a sense, the mystery of existence, the mystery of defining awareness in relation to it. And we, the thing that's aware of itself, I think we talked about this, the doubleness, it's aware of being aware.
Mm-hmm.
But the closest we can get to it is that you have an image of what you're aware of, and then you make an image of the thing that's making you aware of something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you say your mind, what's your image of your mind, or what's the image of the universe?
Yeah, well, see, these it can be thought of as contexts within larger context, within larger context, within, you know, nested contexts.
Or then in ratio. See, that's where the ratio comes in. It's one nested context, but that's in figure ground to another nested relationship. So there's your doubleness. You've got the meaning, the big picture, and the local picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always, I remember you once read Cloning ESP, and it made total sense to you. And then you later reread it and didn't make any sense anymore. But I begin with the interaction between two people and the blocking and the merging. And the blocking and merging has images associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking, we have images, and we're negotiating where the conversation is going. Like right now, you're listening to what I'm saying, but you're also thinking to the side on another track about where you may have wanted this to go to make a point you meant 5 minutes ago, as well as where this would go based on what I'm adding to it, as well as listening to what I'm saying right now. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's all true.
There's a doubleness in there,
mm-hmm.
or an echo, or two tracks going on.
Yeah.
And that's what, so when you use the term awareness, we should talk about the image you have of awareness. Because when we talk about the universe, we get all kinds of images that are associated with that, usually Hubble telescope images, or, I don't know, whatever you read in Indian literature. But someone 100 years ago had totally different images for what the word universe was. They may not even have the word universe. I mean, it was just called God,
mm-hmm.
or it's called the world. You know what I mean? It's the bouncing around of images.
Yeah. Well, I have another image to bring to the table, and that is when you talk about, when the Evergreens talked about the death process, and they say you die and you either go into a dream state or you don't, but eventually you wake up and you recognize yourself to be this soul at the center of 3,000 lifetimes. And
yeah, now that would be, you recognize your soul, you probably experience something and certain kind of weird images of the figure ground relationship of you looking at all your lives. You feel that environment, and you may not even think of it as a soul. That might be a human dimension word. You might have another word for it, or not even a word, isn't even part of the mindset that is experiencing it.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely you have a different world of imagery. And that's why probably the Evergreens say it's hard to communicate death or what it's like, because it's totally different and it evokes different kinds of thinking or imagery.
Mm-hmm.
So back to, I was just taking particular about your idea of the soul, but back to what...
Well, yeah, so let's imagine that you find yourself seeing that you evolve out of your personal identified sense of your label and who you are as a little body on the planet right now, and you move into a space where you find yourself at the center of 3,000 lifetimes,
right,
which spread across time from what we perceive in this dimension to be past to future, but from that dimension, probably past and future aren't even relevant to anything. And let's say that's the dimension of the soul. From the perceived dimension of being incarnate in flesh right now and having a personal sense of identity and a personal sense of history, well, that's a subset of this larger sense of oneself as being at the center of 3,000 lifetimes.
Yeah, there's a doubleness. The person, the being experiencing the bigger picture, 3,000 lives, and then the particular was that life they just had in relation to the big picture. There's a doubleness.
Right. And then the question arises, is one more real than the other? See, I think that the persona that we experience ourselves to be in this lifetime is can be undone. That you can pull the threads out, the complex of thoughts and feelings that make up the persona of who you identify yourself to be in this lifetime. Those threads can be pulled apart and the fabric can become undone and you can become part of something. You can recognize yourself as being conscious in some larger context.
Okay, so that means recognize an image for your big picture track. Have a different image. But you're parallel, what you're saying is parallel to what LaRouche is talking about, the unraveling of the little me. You're putting it in a more, a bunch of images from spiritualism or something, you know, within another life or other lives, a reincarnation. LaRouche is saying it can be unraveled within a secular context.
Yeah.
His salvation is not to find another big image, but to get into the creative process itself.
Mm.
Because that's the, what's he called, the merger of the ego ideal?
Mm-hmm.
That's it. The ego ideal and the notion of inner self are instead united in a single quality. Now that sentence, that definitely could be agreed with by a Buddhist or the Dalai Lama just on the word level. But the images that LaRouche has for that probably different from the Dalai Lama.